Hi, everyone. This week in Retronauts Pocket, you're going to regret giving money to Kickstarter. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the off-week episode, the first off-week episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, the host of this tiny episode, and with me we have a cast of people who might be familiar with you if you have been listening over the past week. To my right,
Dr. Sparkle of Cruntendo fame.
Ray Barnell.
And I'm Bob Mackey.
And again, we're funded by Kickstarter, which is you, and we're doing mini podcasts on the weeks between the big episodes, and we're just kind of going off the rails a little bit, or maybe not off the rails, off script maybe, a little bit with these smaller episodes, and tackling things that maybe we wouldn't in one of the big episodes. And what I'd like to do, at least for some of these that I'm hosting, which will be every third one, is talk about some of the things that have influenced video games over the years. Not necessarily the games themselves, but things that helped to inspire video games or helped to inspire the people who create video games. And this week we're going to talk about something that I hold near and dear to my heart because something inside of me is broken, and that is progressive rock music. And even though he denies it, I think Dr. Sparkle is something of a fan of prog rock music. He uses a sample of Can in his Cruntendo episodes as outro music, and Can is pretty much the quintessential progressive krautrock band.
Well, you know, a lot of aficionados of krautrock actually look down on prog rock.
Oh, everyone who is involved in prog rock looks down on prog rock. No one will actually cop to being a progressive rock musician. It's a pejorative term that everyone else tries to distance themselves from.
I think people now like disco more.
Yeah, I think
disco
so.
Disco is not a bad word.
The punk scene in like 1975 and thereon really turned that entire concept of like sort of involved structure music into something of a dirty word. And it's a shame because, yeah, a lot of progressive rock was really, really pompous and pretentious and over the top and bloated. But a lot of it was really, really creative and interesting. And it, you know, sometimes it just celebrated excellence in musicality. And that's something I enjoy. I don't know. There are certainly some prog acts that I don't want to listen to, but when I put on my headphones, I'm perfectly happy to listen to a 15-minute rock symphony performed by three dudes with a pipe cathedral organ. You know, whatever. Like, I like music, and I think a big part of the reason why a lot of video game music has resonated with me is because prog rock, which I grew up listening to, had a huge influence on a lot of the key composers, especially guys from Japan. For whatever reason, progressive rock has been really, really popular in Italy and Japan. I don't know why, but those two countries really kind of gravitated toward that sound. You know, maybe I can't do two podcasts in a row. My brain's starting to short circuit.
The secret twist of this episode is going to
be,
the secret twist is going to be people are going to find out that they do like prog rock.
Right.
They just don't know it.
Yeah. So let's just carry on with my spoonerisms. I'm sure it'll be fine. So since this doesn't turn into me just lecturing for half an hour, Dr. Sparkle, why don't you talk a little bit about what you know of or think of progressive rock, like just kind of your own experiences with it?
Well, I mean, yeah, progressive rock requires, as opposed to a lot of pop music, a pretty big attention span. I mean, it's not really to the point of classical music or jazz music, but it's not something you sort of have to put your attention to it. It's not something that's necessarily going to be background music. It's music that you really sort of have to listen to very closely. Right. And as for why it became popular in Japan, I don't really know. There was, you know, it's not something people know about there, but there actually was a pretty decent Japanese underground music scene in the 60s and 70s. There were some Japanese prog rock bands. Kotaro, for example, was in a prog rock band back in the early 70s.
I did not realize that.
back, but that was before he became the new agey mm-hmm. tinkly. A lot of prog rock guys actually did go into new agey tinkly.
Yeah, especially
stuff.
The guys from Yes.
Like Vangelis, another
right.
good example.
John Anderson of Yes and Vangelis performed together a lot. They had a couple of albums. Actually, they had a very popular song, The Friends of Mr. Cairo, that they did together. And that's like, there's a radio cut that's like 3 minutes long. And then there's the real Friends of Mr. Cairo that's like 10 minutes long. And also Rick Wakeman, probably the most popular and best known keyboardist from Yes, went on to do like his kind of crazy thematic, very like I love the UK's history.
He's like those Knights of the Round Table right, record.
He did a series of musical tone poems on the Six Wives of Henry VIII. There's an album. It's just six pieces of music that are musical interpretations of the personalities of the wives of Henry VIII.
See, for prog, there's like a sweet spot, you know, where it's not yet too pretentious and boring.
Right.
And, but, like, for example, I think Yes's Tales of Topographic Oceans is when it, like, it crossed that line.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Tales of Topographic Oceans is it's a two-record
album.
It's
a snoozer.
It's four tracks that are 20 minutes long a piece, roughly. And that was them getting a little too clever because people were like, according to their words, they heard people say, oh, Yes is making all these long songs. What are they going to do next? Put the Bible to music? And they said, all right. So they put like Hindu scriptures to music. And it's very philosophical. And yeah, it kind of drags in places, like a lot of places. I still have a fondness for it because my mother owned it and she would like put her records on cassette tapes and like play the music when we were on car trips and stuff. And so when I finally heard that album, I was like, oh man, I've heard all this stuff before. So there's like this part of me that's conditioned to like it, no matter how pretentious it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Yes is kind of probably maybe the best known of the prog acts. I mean, I guess Pink Floyd, but they kind of strayed from time to time into other areas.
Disco.
Pink Floyd into disco.
Well, you know, that Another Brick in the Wall basically had like a little disco beat in it.
Yeah, I don't really think of that as being super disco, though, because it lacks a lot of the other signatures
of
disco.
Super disco, but, I mean...
There's not a lot of...
No, that's more like Curtis Mayfield or something. But and even Money had like kind of like a funky mm-hmm. bass line going through it. They would sort of veer off into pop music.
Well, we should maybe go back to the start, and a lot of progressive rock acts came from the psychedelic era. If you look at, I don't know, who are some examples? Well, Pink Floyd started out as a psychedelic band back when, I totally forgot his name, the original guitarist.
Sid Barrett?
Yes, Sid Barrett. When he was with the band, like they did a lot of psychedelic stuff. Piper at the Gates of Dawn, their first album, is like totally just psychedelic. I have.
I wasn't trying to be snide by saying this or anything, but it seemed like the rise of prog rock had a lot to do with drug culture, which is why someone would sit there and listen to an album-long song because they're really stoned. It seems like that was part of it, which was strange why that caught on in Japan. Not that you need to be high to appreciate it, but it was so tied up in drug culture that, I don't know, It seems Japan, they're hand in hand.
Japan has always been very shy about drugs. Like, they love their whiskey.
Right, they
and
do.
Their beer. Santori. But yeah, like, drugs are not that common over in Japan.
Oh, I mean, I think they're quite illegal. I mean, more illegal than they are here in some ways. And when I've met Japanese psychedelic musicians, I mean, a lot of them do not actually do drugs. I mean, for them, it's just all, it's like a mental spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'm someone who's never gotten high. Like, I've never smoked or shot up anything. And I like this music a lot without, you know, ever drinking alcohol until I was much older in life than listening to the music.
In all seriousness, I mean, try listening to those records again with drugs and you'll see a huge difference.
I'm sure. I mean, there are some things like I like the really structured stuff where it's, you know, it's very dense music and it's clearly composed and a lot of thought has been put into how the musical parts fit together. But then there's stuff like, you know, a lot of Can's improvisational stuff, like, there's an entire half of their two record set, Tagomago, that's basically just like a dude going, oh, with echoey effects. And
it's basically like a haunted house record.
I can't listen to that because having not been stoned before, like, yeah, that stuff is unlistenable to me. But then, you know, on the flip side of that, they have this 20-minute track called Alalua that's basically just like a 20-minute dance beat. And there's all these improvisations that happen over top of it. And it's really interesting. Like, I remember letting some friends hear that in college, and they had a hard time believing it was something recorded in the early 70s because it sounded more like the kind of music you would have heard in the 90s with, like, not an electronic beat, but, like, a drum loop. Mm. And just that kind of general style, like, that was kind of coming into vogue in the 90s.
Yeah, a lot of those sort of early mid-70s bands do have like a weird timeless feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those guys actually later did become influential on early techno musicians.
Mm-hmm.
A guy called Manuel Gottsching did an album called E2E4, I think like late 70s, that became sort of like one of kind of like the cornerstones of techno music.
And Steve Hillage of Gong went on to be part of The Orb, or like involved with The Orb.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, there's kind of this continuity, and it's like, you know, just really talented musicians who were interested in doing something other than creating 3-minute rock songs for the radio. And sometimes those ideas found expression as psychedelic music, sometimes as like kind of new agey type stuff, sometimes as electronica. I mean, Mike Oldfield isn't technically new age or progressive rock, but there are elements of both in some of his Tubular Bells, and you know, people know that as the theme to The Exorcist, but like the actual Tubular Bells is a single album song that goes all over the place, and it's kind of crazy. But yeah, it's just a lot of experimentation. It's a lot of the things that I kind of like in, you know, indie games, actually. Like, a lot of discipline, a lot of experimentation, a lot of willingness to just try things. And for every band you have that, you know, people are like, oh, that's bloated and stupid, like, there's all kinds of creativity lurking under the surface.
At that time in Britain in the 60s, jazz music was also a huge thing. Sid Barrett was sort of trying to become like the John Coltrane of guitar. In what he was doing, sort of doing these extended improvisations on guitar. I mean, that whole sort of like mid-60s free jazz thing was something that blew a lot of minds in the 60s.
Yeah, and I think that kind of like that free jazz evolved into things like fusion jazz, which were kind of very similar in purpose. And yeah, improvisation was a really big deal with bands like King Crimson. I mean, that's always been a part of King Crimson's repertoire, even now with all the weird little things Robert Fripp, the lead guitarist of King Crimson, does on the side. But again, like, he's gone into kind of some weird experimental places. He had a just like a soundscape album that he did with Brian Eno called No Pussyfooting. And I think there was also an album called something like Radio for, or Music for Airports or something like that.
Well, that was a Brian Eno album.
Oh, was it? Yeah. But Robert Fripp
worked with him. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Robert Fripp was not involved in that particular album.
Oh, was he
but
not?
They, I don't think so. But Eno and Fripp actually had a sequel to that whose name escapes me at the moment.
But, I mean, you know, they... Robert Fripp was a very, very technical guitarist. There was a rumor that he was actually tone deaf and couldn't play like a chromatic scale. But I don't think that's true. But he did take a very still does take a very disciplined approach to guitar and treats it almost like almost kind of mechanically. So it, you know, like he was kind of the guiding voice behind King Crimson, and it made King Crimson's music very technical and very involved. But at the same time, they would also do these improvisations. But instead of being like jazz style improvisations or based on blues riffs, it was just like, it's really hard to describe. I don't know if you've heard any of King Crimson's improv stuff, but it's not very friendly to the ear.
Well, yeah, and I guess some people listen to that and they understand what's going on musically, sort of what's trying to happen. Other people, it just sounds like noise to them. Mm-hmm. It's something that simply can't be appreciated by everybody.
Right, but it is interesting because when they kind of, you know, we're all synced up together and kind of in the same place, all those sort of dissonant sounds would come together and turn into these really cool grooves, and then they would sort of dissolve out again. But, you know, that would be one end of the King Crimson spectrum, and then the other end would be these incredibly technical pieces that would like slowly build into something and then kind of explode and then disappear back down and build up again. So yeah, I mean, prog music is kind of all over the place. There's not really any one kind of music you can pin down and say, this is progressive rock. And that's something that's interesting about it to me, is that on one end you have really, really kind of twee stuff like Camel and Gentle Giant. And on the other hand, you have, I mean, some people consider Led Zeppelin and like harder edged bands like that, Uriah Heep or Hawkwind, which, you know, spun off into Motorhead as progressive acts. So it covers a really wide spectrum. And I like Gentle Giant though, because they're kind of like math teachers who became rock musicians. It's very, very fussy and, yeah, it's musicians' music, I guess, except I have no musical talent. But there is a very heavy British element to progressive rock, I've noticed. Most of it kind of came out of the UK, and you do have some sort of splinter bands like Kansas and Rush that came out of the US or Canada, but it's not very common. It's mostly a British phenomenon, at least the big acts.
Well, yeah, there was like that whole scene in England in the mid-60s that was sort of centered around in London in clubs like... the UFO Club and the Roundhouse and Middle Earth. So there was like this huge sort of breeding ground for all these acts. They all heard each other. And that, kind of like punk in New York in the 70s, it just caused this huge explosion of bands. And there was no sort of like ground zero for prog in the US. It was people, yeah, they heard the albums and they said, I'm going to start my own prog band. But there wasn't like an area where all these bands were coming from all at once.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just that kind of centralized culture again. You know, it's like Tokyo in Japan, London in England. America doesn't really have that. I mean, we have New York City.
There is no musical capital in this country. Right.
Austin, maybe, but no. I don't know.
Graceland? Yeah. To bring it back to something more modern, like I can see, I mean, even though progressive rock is sort of a bad word now, I can see certain bands that can be considered slightly progressive in the terms of music, like the Arcade Fire. I mean, would you consider them slightly prog rock? Because they just, every song is so, I mean, not in terms of length, but like, okay, we're going to have a pipe organ on this song noodling around, or we're going to like bring in some weird instrument on this track. I don't know, maybe I'm way off base.
Well, no, there's definitely a prog influence in those kind of bands.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the actual core prog audience has moved on to other things, mostly like probably like progressive metal and technical metal and all those.
That is true.
Ridiculous bands.
I think I was also thinking of like how theatrical Arcade Fire is also, and that's something I think about.
Yeah,
like
that's prog rock. That was definitely something that bands like ELP and Genesis were really into. But Peter also, Gabriel with Genesis used to come out on stage dressed in crazy costumes that had nothing to do with the music usually. Mm-hmm. Like he would, you know, come out for singing about aliens watching humanity from afar, dressed in a red dress and a fox's head. Who knows why?
Because he could,
yeah, basically.
But at the same time, I mean, stuff like David Bowie, they were doing also that whole theatrical thing, mm-hmm. Alice Cooper. And yeah. I think probably a band like Arcade Fire draws more from that than from something like Genesis.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Weird and Gilly.
So at some point in time, a bunch of Japanese college students were listening to this. And who are they? Who should we talk about?
Yeah, I mean, this all kind of came to a head for me when I was interviewing Nobu Uematsu, the composer of very, very many Final Fantasy games last year. And you know, I asked him about his influences, and he said there were two bands that he really loved. And when he was in college, he'd just be hanging out with his friends, listening to albums, and you know, wanting to become a musician himself. And those bands were Uriah Heep and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And it's the first time I've ever heard a musician say I like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, because that's pretty much a dirty word. So yeah, that was really interesting to me. But you know, mm-hmm. I've always been kind of drawn to that particular school of game music, you know, Uematsu, Yasunori Mitsuda, who did the Chrono Cross and Chrono Trigger, Xenogears soundtracks, Yoko Shimomura. There's a lot of Japanese musicians who kind of have like a very clear progressive rock
influence. I'd say, yeah, Sakuraba, he's not the best guy, but he's clearly like...
Yeah, I don't like his music very much, but yeah, he definitely has that kind of... like, he is to progressive rock, or to, you know, progressive rock influence musicians like... Nobu Uematsu as Dream Theater is to classic progressive rock. It's like they're kind of coming from the same place, but not quite as good. Anyway.
That analogy, yeah, I need to like do some research to understand that analogy.
Yeah, but... well, go listen to some Dream Theater and yeah.
Well, I'm sure we'll have lots of clips.
Anyway, I don't know. What would you kind of consider the quintessence of progressive rock? Like, I think progressive rock is a really stupid name, for one thing, because people still perform that kind of style. And at this point, it's not really progressive because it all happened 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, but at the time, it's kind of like calling the first half of the 20th century modern.
Right.
You know, it was a good name at the time. It doesn't make any sense nowadays. But, you know, the name's already stuck, so there's nothing we can do about it now. In England, a lot of those bands were, there was like a snooty edge to them. One phrase I've heard is that in the early 70s, prog was Big Brother's music and glam was Little Brother's music. The young kids listened to glam, which was poppier. The older, more sophisticated boys listened to prog rock. But, and there was also, they were actually sort of drawing a lot on sort of hoity-toity stuff like classical music. I mean, much more so than we ever did here in the U.S. You couldn't really get away with that in the U.S. But for like a lot of these musicians who went to these fancy schools, they soaked up that sort of not quite upper class British culture, But they had like a big respect for tradition, and they wanted to put that into pop music.
Yeah, in America, you had like a dude performing Flight of the Bumblebee on a guitar, and you're like, wow, that's really crazy. But but you know, a lot of the British musicians went to prep schools, and they went to, you know, like very traditional British schools, like you said. Like Genesis, I think, is probably the best example of that. Like that was a bunch of sort of upper class schoolboys who got together and were like, all right, let's make some music that's kind of classical. And so they were singing about, you know, mythology and ancient history and things like that. And then their drummer quit, so they brought in, like, a blue-collar bloke named Phil Collins, and that totally changed the nature of the band. But yeah, there was kind of, like, that sort of... I don't know if snootiness is the right word, but...
there was, like, a need to be thought of as being legitimate. Mm-hmm. That somehow, if you added these elements into music, it would make pop music more legitimate. It would make it more, you know, quote unquote, art.
Mm-hmm. Like class issues are much bigger in Britain than they are here, and I feel like that's probably a reflection of, you know, class issues in
right.
the country.
And I'm sure that's why the punk scene was so big on tearing down, you know, walking around with a shirt that says Pink Floyd sucks.
Though oddly, you know who a big Can fan is? Johnny Rotten.
But he probably doesn't think of Can as progressive rock. He probably thinks of them as, you know, this cool band from Germany. They're not prog because I don't hate them. Huh. It's such a meaningless label. You can just attach it to anything.
That's sort of the way you draw the line in the sand with prog. If you hate it,
right.
it's not prog. If you like it, it's something else.
Well,
if you hate it, it is prog. If you like it,
right.
Then it's something
else. No, that was something different. Right. Which is why people can like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, but still think, oh my God, Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Well,
I
mean, they were the worst. As Lester Bang said, they were worse than war criminals.
Wow.
Man, I don't know about that. Wow. But the thing is, it's interesting because ELP came out of like very legitimate background roots, came out of King Crimson, which was kind of an explosion when it happened in, what, 1968? Like 1969?
I think in 69 the first album came out.
But I mean, yeah, like they were performing this incredibly technical music live that no one had ever heard anything like that before. And it really like caught a lot of people's attention. Before ELP, Keith Emerson was with The Nice, which was really kind of the bridge between psychedelia and that like post-Beatles, wannabe classical music, you know, Phil Spector, Wall of Sound, Bolted On. Like The Nice really did that, and then Emerson kind of drifted away and said, let's just do that with three dudes and like a bunch of keyboards.
Palmer from Atomic Rooster or something
like that? And I think The Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
Right.
So, like, not as big a names, but...
Still, they were considered to be a quote-unquote supergroup.
Right. And actually, ELP was originally, like, its foundation was that Keith Emerson wanted to work with Jimi Hendrix.
Hmm.
But Hendrix had passed away, obviously, before that could happen. But they were talking about forming a band together. Can't even imagine. That would have been really strange. But, you know, if you've only heard ELP, that might seem really weird. But if you hear what Emerson was doing with The Nice and, like, the fact that he was going out onto stage and stabbing his pipe organ with a knife to hold down chords while he was improvising over it, you were like, oh, yeah, I could see him maybe getting along with Hendrix.
Huh.
So, anyway, that's progressive rock. But I do want to talk about, you know, why... it's perhaps had so much influence on video games. And I mean, maybe it's because it is that kind of like music for musicians appeal to it. And again, you know, because so many of the prog influenced musicians were from Japan, but not all of them. I mean, I feel like, you know, a lot of guys who were kind of big on C64, what's his name? Galway. It seems like there's a lot of that kind of influence in a lot of Sid tunes also. I don't know if you're willing to back me up on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, when I hear like Sid tunes or old Commodore 64 music, I'm not really sure what its musical roots are. It almost sounds like something that kind of sprung up just based on what you could do with that equipment. But I have a hard time sometimes attaching genres to video game music, because it's sort of music that's written for a very specific purpose. And I guess prog rock kind of makes sense, because you can sort of, you have a certain amount of length involved, and you can sort of, there's not going to be any words. It's going to be pretty much, you know, no lyrics. And you sort of have to have something in the background that will sort of get the listener's interest, but will not overpower what's actually going on the screen. So it's like that, and classical are sort of like a good template for video game music. Like when I say classical, I mean like more like movie soundtrack classical.
Right.
And in the West, we have like a lot of the movie soundtrack type video game soundtracks, like Skyrim.
Well,
or something.
I mean, yeah, you have Jeremy Soule has a pretty. I don't know. I feel like Skyrim might be an exception, because it does kind of draw beyond just Hollywood. But you definitely have guys like Harry Gregson Williams doing music for Metal Gear games. They, like Kojima just said, I love some Hollywood. So he went out and found a composer that he liked from Hollywood and said, make my music, please. But then, you know, also on the Metal Gear games, you have guys like Norihiko Hibino, who bring in a lot of the kind of like electronic inspirations that sort of evolved to some degree out of bands like maybe Tangerine Dream or Yellow Magic Orchestra, which were, you know, like one step removed from progressive rock. So it also, does tend to have kind of that influence.
Like, he's trained in jazz too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, yeah. Yep. Hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's, there's kind of that blending of genres, but, you know, like you said, game music is very much about limitations, or it used to be. Maybe it's not so much anymore, but when you're looking at chiptunes, when you're looking at, you know, 8 and 16-bit soundtracks, there were only so many instruments you could use at a time, so many voices, and bands like Rush and ELP, whatever you may think of them, really excelled at taking this very limited ensemble of 3 or 4 people and creating a lot of sound live out of some instruments by using a lot of different techniques and using really, really skilled musicianship. And, you know, a lot of that involves a lot of arpeggios and very complex performances that video game chips are really good at doing. And you have, you know, you listen to a soundtrack like, I don't know, Mega Man 2 or something, and you have just three sound channels, but there's some really great music happening. It's because it's very complicated and it's all interlocked. And yeah, it makes me think of an interview I read once with the drummer from Yes, Bill Bruford, who was talking about how difficult it was to play with the bassist from Yes, Chris Squire, because Squire always plays like really, really high up in the bass register. Like he doesn't do the really deep notes. He's like playing up really high. So Bruford's like, you know, he's playing in the sound space where I normally perform. So as a result of that, I have to think about how I'm hitting the drums and the kind of sounds I'm making. And so I have to work around where Squire likes to play. And like, I feel like that kind of discipline really comes into composing game music.
I'm sure both composing game music on like for the 8-bit system or the 16-bit system, it involves, I'm sure, a lot of problem solving, which is probably a lot of what happens in prog rock as well. I mean, you sort of have to plan everything out very carefully. You have to sort of, as you say, work around the limitations. I can see how they would sort of appeal to like a very similar mindset, and I think that might be kind of like a nerdy mindset, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, a lot of the kind of key stars in prog music dressed like rock stars, but yeah, you kind of knew that they were dorks underneath it all.
For Uematsu, though, did he write prog-influenced stuff for games before FF6? Because I feel like from that point on, like every battle song was a prog rock-influenced composition, or every boss fight song. I just can't remember. I can't think of anything before that could clearly.
I mean, the battle themes in Final Fantasy IV and V.
Yeah, like the boss
totally
themes.
Just like
definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear LP in that, but yeah, the point at which I really stopped and said, this game music really reminds me of something that I've heard before, was the final battle theme for Final Fantasy VI, where you're fighting Kefka. Structure of it, and even the instrumentation of it, and some of the themes and the melodies, reminds me a lot of an early ELP track called The Three Fates, where it's hard to explain, but it's basically like The Three Fates is kind of structured into three different phases, and it starts off with like an organ, and it's not a lot of a heavy beat, but then the drums kick in, and it kind of like starts to build on that, and that's exactly how Dancing Mad sounds. Mm-hmm. Like when I heard those two and kind of compare them side to side, they're not the same track, but it was really clear to me that Uematsu had been influenced by music like that. And so I started to pay more attention to it and started to listen to more like that. More listen for more of those influences in game music. I'm so sure to a certain degree I'm talking out my ass, but that's what being a fan is all about.
I wonder if a lot of video game composers like that, if they listen to stuff like Goblin or sort of like the prog soundtrack genre.
That I couldn't tell you.
I mean, it makes sense because if you listen to stuff like Goblin or, well, Tubular Bells was not soundtrack music, but it influenced all those similar soundtracks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like prog that's been reined in a little bit. There's not so much action at the forefront. I mean, there's things of musical interest going on, but it's sort of kept at a level where you can sort of put it in the background. And a lot of video game music, like stuff like music from Chrono Cross or Xeno Gears or something, has that. And there's also like a big Celtic influence that guy in particular. Music.
Mitsuda is very, very heavily influenced by Celtic music.
But this sort of prog to new age to Celtic. I mean, a lot of like the modern or like, 70s, 80s Celtic bands, I think they got some influence from prog as well. So all those musical genres to me seem all sort of kind of tied in a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, whether you like it or not, progressive rock does have a lot of connections to a lot of other things. I love those family trees that they used to do. I don't know if they still do those with bands, but like...
Yeah, this one guy always did like hundreds of those.
Right, yeah. I remember buying a Yes Rock box set back in the 90s, and like there was this huge thing the size of the box set that was like the Yes family tree. And that was, back in the 90s before they'd hired all these other new people who have been in the band since. But yeah, it just kind of shows you all the connections. And... so it's not like I'm not trying to claim that progressive rock is this wellspring of inspiration and brilliance, but I do think it's interesting that it does have like a very clear and distinct influence on people. And one last minor thing is that progressive rock was one of the first rock genres that really just embraced synthesizers in a big way. They had been used. The Beatles used them to a certain degree, and
so did the Monkees.
Yeah, the Monkees, but it was. Bands like, again, Genesis and Pink Floyd that really put them in the front and were like, we're going to make our music around synthesizers. Or in Genesis's case, they loved Mellotrons, which were kind of like a... Are you guys familiar with Mellotrons?
I'm not.
They're like the best instrument. They're the worst to use because they're just incredibly fussy. But it's basically, before there was digital sampling, there would be these machines that were like a keyboard, and each key was attached to a tape loop for a certain sound. So you could get tape loops of different pitches of strings or choirs or whatever, and it has this really distinctive sound. And like, these things were analog and they broke down all the time and they hated touring.
Is that how you make dogs bark jingle bells?
Yes. But, you know, Mellotrons and Moogs and other synthesizers were really big in a lot of prog music. Keith Emerson would switch back and forth in ELP between an organ and a synthesizer. And so that became kind of a defining part of that musical sound before, you know, before the 80s when synthesizers really became like sequencing and drum machines and that sort of thing became just kind of a part of pop music. Like that was very big in a lot of the prog genre type bands. And I mean, obviously that must have been very attractive to gay musicians because like they had to work with synthesized sound. So I feel like it was kind of a natural reference point for them. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, you know, Yellow Magic Orchestra needs to be mentioned because they were kind of their own thing, but they were pretty much probably the number one influence on most Japanese gay composers in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, you're probably right there. In fact, just played a game, Far East of Eden, in which the theme music was actually written by the guy from Yellow Magic Orchestra. I don't know how much video game music he's actually done, but I guess he has ventured out a bit.
What is his name? Ryuhei?
Sakamoto.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yuichi.
Yuichi, okay. That's right. I know he's been involved to some degree in game music, but yeah, he's I've talked to several game composers over the past few years who were just like, oh yeah, I listen to them all the time. Michiro Yamane was one of them.
Yeah.
Like her big influences were Bach and Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Hmm.
So you put those together and you basically get video game music or prog rock, one of the two.
And one of the guys, Hosono is his name, from YMO. He did like a video game music cover album in the 80s. He covered like Namco music and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was like his project. So
yeah,
that was, yeah. You know, seems to go to them a lot. And it's not just composers either. It's like I've interviewed Kazayabe from my magazine, latest mm-hmm. issue of Scroll. He just, you know, he would talk about YMO a lot on Twitter, and he is just like super into electronic music in general mm-hmm. as well. Which is like, it's not direct inspiration for the games he made, but like, it's pretty ingrained in mm-hmm. a lot of those people.
Well, I guess YMO was the big electronic band in Japan at that time. You don't really normally associate Japanese music of the late 70s, early 80s with electronica. So I think they were pretty much it. There were, I'm sure, a few other smaller bands, but
yeah.
I think they were actually like a legitimate commercial success in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were. I asked Uematsu if he was influenced by YMO, and he was like, no, those guys were ripoffs. I liked Kraftwerk.
Kraftwerk.
I liked Kraftwerk, yeah.
They did good Kraftwerk.
So yeah, there's that snobbery again. Anyway, yeah, so I don't know. I just wanted to talk about this a little bit and put it out there. And now I can't wait for people to tell me how stupid I am and why did you put this stuff into my podcast? But
that's what the internet is for.
It pretty much is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. These are two things that I love a lot, video games and crazy pretentious music from the 70s. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about their intersection. Next time I'll talk about something a little more palatable to the general public, I promise. But hopefully you've enjoyed this little mini episode, and I hope the samples that I've added here have tickled your ears and rather than anger your soul.
That's so pretentious.
Anyway, so that's it for Retronauts Pocket Episode 1.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back next week with a full-fledged episode. And so thanks for listening, Dr. Sparkle. Thanks again for driving all this way to be on our podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And for being much smarter about this topic than I am.
Hmm.
And so check out retronauts.com and all of our social media outlets because we have a lot of them.
We do.
We love you. So thanks. Well, you can-